For Pauline Kael, the movies were just that, movies. They weren't so stuffy as to be called films, the people who made them not so precious as to be treated like stars. As a movie critic, most notably for The New Yorker magazine, Pauline Kael set the bar for movie writing, moving it higher and higher and higher. She was personal and pointed. She could be scathing about what irritated or outraged her, and she could also be rapturous about what delighted and amazed her. She had famous powers of observation. It was said that she could see a movie just once and recall it frame by frame. She championed Robert Altman when he was an unknown director of industrial films, and Woody Allen when some critics doubted the ability of a comedian to make movies. She persuaded audiences to seek out Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde, and also found much to admire in Dumb and Dumber. Pauline Kael died this week at the age of 82. She had Parkinson's disease. Our entertainment critic Elvis Mitchell joins us on the line from Toronto. Elvis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
And she was a good friend of yours.
Yes, she was. One of the first things she ever said to me was that she hated being called a film critic. And she just thought that was a bunch of garbage and was not afraid to say that.
Wait, how far do you go back? When did you guys meet?
Gosh, I met her when she was doing a book tour for When the Lights Go Down in 1980. I was still in school in Detroit, and she had come through. I was doing a radio interview at WJR, and I knew the producer of the program, so I decided I would go over just to introduce myself to her, and, you know, that would be the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember she was sitting there and just tiny, you know, a hood ornament, basically, a little person. And I just sat down there, and we started to talk about movies, and I thought, well, that was it, I'm done. And she was being taken off to the interview, and she grabbed me by the wrist and dragged me along. And I said, no, I'm not part of this interview. She said, oh, I know, just come along and sit with me. And so I did, and the next day I wanted to do an interview with her for WDET, where I worked. I remember dressing up for this interview, wearing a dark blue suit, a blue shirt, a navy blue tie, and I showed up, and she said, oh, honey, whose funeral did you just come from?
I mean, now you're the movie critic of the New York Times. Did she ever give you some advice about movie criticism?
I think if I got anything from her, it was just to write the way you speak, which is what she did. And what was so astonishing about this is that those intricate turns of phrase, that masterful mind, was all manifest in the way she talked.
We're fortunate, you know, enough to have some tapes in-house here from really her first days in criticism, when she was the critic of KPFA, the Pacifica station in Berkeley. This must be from the early 60s, or mid-60s. She reviewed Stanley Kubrick's Lolita. Let's hear some of what she said.
Lolita is so clumsily structured that you begin to wonder what was shot and then cut out, why other pieces were left in, and was the beginning intended to be the end. It's as if Kubrick lost his nerve. If he did, it's no wonder. The wonder is that with all the pressures on American movie makers, he had the nerve to transform this satire on the myths of love into the medium that has become consecrated to those myths.
Ouch. It's one thing to write that way when you're the New Yorker's critic. It's another way to write that when you're reviewing it for, with all due regards to Pacifica, a radio station of great reputation with a small audience in the Bay Area. But she still, even then, carried that authority.
Well, part of it was that what was important was just not the venue, but what you had to say. Even the youth of the voice, you used to hear those words just kind of tumbling out of her head, these things that she had to say. There was nothing dispassionate about it, but at the same time, the thoughts were so rounded, and each word seemed to have exactly the right place in the sentence. But there was a laugh, and also a wonderful profane streak. I mean, people call her writing slangy, but there's nothing slangy about what we just heard.
I'm curious to hear a clip we have queued up now, reviewing David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia.
Why, if I enjoyed the movie, am I so angry about it? It's rather complicated. They attempt to do the impossible, even as Lawrence did, and they end up in compromises and simplifications and cuts. They wind up with beautiful cinematography and blood and battles, and what is sacrificed is the figure of Lawrence. Too complex a hero for the spectacle form, so he becomes a series of literary flourishes.
Boy. I like that, and I like that film, but I like what she says about that. What would she like to go to a movie with?
Oh, it was pretty wonderful, actually, because she would gasp if something was awful and sort of whisper back and forth. I had to watch myself because we would end up talking quite a bit, and she was just all those enthusiasms that you imagine she would have.
Did she say ever anything about the fact that this young man she kind of anointed with her handshake in Detroit in 1980, you know, winds up, without getting carried away about it, winds up reviewing films for the New York Times?
Oh, gee. I guess what she said was, I've finally become a solid citizen. And I think the gift that she gave me was just to, I was lucky to do what I loved. And I had to sort of communicate that I loved what I did. And I think she loved what she did, too. And she tried to say in her work that movies were not just this sort of debased form, but they were, when they were really functioning and informed by art. And she was a sensualist, I think, in the end. And so I guess what I would really like to say at this point is that she was my friend and I will miss her.
Elvis, thanks very much.
Thanks, Scott.
Elvis Mitchell, film critic for the New York Times, speaking from Toronto.